Welcome everyone again to the Human to Human podcast. I'm Tennyson Wolfe and I'm host of this podcast. And I created it a while back because I really wanted to be in some of the ongoing conversations that I was in with interesting people and record it, realizing there's something fruitful and important to be able to offer to others. In this day and age when an average person like me with limited technical skills can record things and share them out into the world. I basically join in this podcast as a person who likes to learn, appreciates my friends and colleagues who are also in their levels of learning or their levels of practice. And we get to have a conversation that does have a particular tone around some of the deeper humanity of the big and little things that we're trying to do with one another. I always have a guest, and today's guest is one that I'm glad to invite in, Dave Furon, who is, among other things, creator of the Practice podcast and also a co-author with Peter Vail of Practice as a Way of Being. There's a lot of layers that I want to touch with Dave, and we'll invite your voice in just a second, Dave. But my reason for inviting you is because we've been in cahoots a little bit lately. We've been in a shared group of co-authors for the collaboratory change piece, some of that that's going on. And we've been able to be on some monthly calls on and off for probably the last year or so. And you struck me as an interesting person to talk with, and also as one who is an elder in our field of OD and change and some of the other ways that that gets named. So, Dave, I feel excited to have a conversation with you today. Welcome to the Human to Human podcast.
Thank you, Tennyson. Yeah, I remember the Author Jam a couple of months ago where we deemed each other authors and, I mean, elders, authors, yes, elders of what the field writ large, the field of humanism applied as it should be to solving the serious problems and the not so serious problems of the world. So yeah, I like being an elder because when I started back in my connection with Peter Vail, when he invited me to help him finish a On Practice as a Way of Being, Peter was a little over 80, as I am today. And I thought of myself as the junior person in the conversation. Peter passed away in 2020, as many people did. When I decided to go forward and continue the Practice podcast and finish the book, it took me another few years, and now I'm in my 80s. So, Peter, thank you for giving me a chance to grow up in these last few years in a different way.
Let's stay there, Dave. I would love to explore a little bit of this relationship that you had with Peter. And I wonder if you could describe a little bit of what was the friendship or what was the mentoring. What was the sharedness that you had together? I'd love to hear a little bit, knowing that you have spoken of Peter often as someone very, very important and significant for you.
Yeah, I think the sort of cellular level teacher of me that I've been since I can remember, long before even high school, something of the teacher in me recognized and found and connected with the teacher who was Peter Vail. And I think he felt the same way, even though at that time it was 1969, 1970, and I was just starting in a doctoral program at the University of Connecticut, and he was a young organization behavior professor, so early in the field that we called it industrial administration, OB, which was created when Peter was in graduate school at Harvard as a named field of teaching behavior and research. was so new that I was fascinated to meet one of the people who was creating how the field could make a difference in a learner's life on the fly. So every class I took with Peter back then, I was 28 or 29, and he was in his early 30s. Every class, every conversation for the next several years, culminating in my finishing my dissertation in the nick of time. Why in the nick of time? Because he told me when he signed it and congratulated me that the moving vans were in his driveway and he and his family were moving to Washington, D.C., where he was to become the dean of the School of Business and Government at George Washington. So then I realized how sometimes timing is everything. I had my PhD and I had a lifelong friend. We continued to stay in touch as often over the years as possible. We connected through the Organization Behavior Teaching Society, of which he was one of the early founders. And I was active in it right up until, well, this year, and received their Life Achievement Award, as did Peter. And so why is that so profound? Because I think, Tennyson, that it was beyond all the intellect and everything else that both of us had, knowing each other as teachers. And therefore, when he asked me to help him, and as he actually was in hospice in the late 2019, I just knew that what he had and he wanted to offer to the world was loaded with important messages to primarily to teachers, but also to the learners. And the teacher message was, know what practice means and how it affects the choices and the outcomes of human life. Theorize all you wish, but if you can't figure out how to connect that theory to what people actually love doing, it will soon be forgotten. So that was our teaching message all the way through to finishing the book. That's a long story about Peter, but I'll tell you, in the years since I represented our work, I keep finding more people who say, oh yeah, Peter Vail, I read his book, or I met him at a conference, or he was a consultant, or he was my dean, or my professor. And all of us have the same tone, which is, thank God.
Beautiful, Dave. I appreciate that. I didn't meet Peter personally, and I was aware of his name, but I do come from the field of organizational behavior. So there is a part of me that bows a little bit to what he contributed and to what you contributed in the spirit of trying to evolve a field. When I went to school, I got to go into the organizational behavior program, and I didn't actually know what I was getting myself into.
None of us do.
But the guidance, right? And that was some of the flavor that was pretty interesting from the faculty back then. But the flavor of it was that we're going to combine a little organization stuff, some system stuff, some deeply human values, some psychology, some of the human aspects of such. And all of that together felt just interesting and compelling to me.
I mean to cut you off, but I think one of the wonderful things that I started in that relationship with Peter, knowing about organization behavior and the people who you meet, teaching it, writing it about it, and so forth, is that we don't know what we're getting ourselves into, and we love it.
Yeah,
because organization is a breaking wave. And just as soon as you think you have pinned it down and you can explain to others how the organization affects their lives and so forth, the wave breaks again. And it's something else now we never thought of before. Therefore, all of different disciplines that they would help us weave together, the arts, the sciences, the humanities, were just so that we could stand the ambiguity to the extent that right to this day, you hear you and I.
Yeah.
Just fascinated with that wonderful, what the hell's going to happen next?
Yeah. So Dave, a lot of the questions I feel like I have with you today, and probably in the other circumstances we're in, they are drawing upon your elderness and your having a few years under your belt of seeing things and maybe seeing patterns and maybe letting go of a few things. So when you name something now about those, reflecting back on those years, being able to be in ambiguity, being able to be in the unknowns, what are you finding helps cohere yourself or others so that they can be in such ambiguity?
Well, what comes to mind is the way I organized my my courses over the years in various schools. 30 years at the last school I taught. I would start with the premise that I and my fellow learners, aka students, were creating a story about a phase of our lives called a 15-week course of study. And so I looked at it as a maybe a sense of theater, and that, you know, we were all on that proverbial stage. I also always made every course, introduction to management, quality, knowledge, leadership, you name the thrust of the course, it was always about an ongoing story called After This. And so as I, every exercise I wrote, everything I asked him to read, I always said, okay, this is us doing the learning of organization behavior. But after this, what do you think has changed? What do you think will change? How do you see yourselves going forward? Because at the end of those 15 weeks, unless you sign up with another class, we'll probably not ever see each other again.
Right.
And so peppered throughout the 289 episodes of the Practice Podcast are conversations with former students of mine, always saying, well, after my class, essentially, what did you do? And what are you doing now? And can you remember any connection between our time in the classroom and how you're feeling about your work today? And of course, they have to tell me they can remember something.
But they're calling it out, Dave.
They are. It's a thrill of teaching, though, is to find out what happens 20 years after with a student that I had that time with on stage, if you will.
Before Peter, were there figures in your life that helped you become the learner that you are?
Yeah, I think context means a lot in any practice that sustains us. And very early in my growing up years, the YMCA of Portland, Maine became a place where I could walk through that door and feel that I was going to be successful whatever hours I was there. And because I wasn't, you know, the little leaguer who could hit the home run or the usual sports things, but at the Y, I could see myself being helpful in so many ways. And one of them was that I helped out teaching swimming. For my junior high assistant principal actually said, could you help me out? Because I can't get in the water right now. It's some kind of a disability. So 12 or 13 or whatever age that was, I started in that little YMCA pool teaching swimming and learning as I was doing it how much those teaching genes were happy and anticipating. And so I ended up teaching lots of different things over the years, all the way through graduating from college, coming back home each semester to teach at the Portland YMCA. And I thought that would be my career. That context, providing a spirit, mind, and body world, you know, for families of all sizes, shapes, and persuasions. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I loved what the Y could be. The YMCA brought me to Flint, Michigan for my master's degree mm-hmm. in a program called the Mott Interdisciplinary Community School Leadership Program. My interest in expanding the impact of schools, public schools, local schools, through something called a community school is something that brought me to my first college job, where I developed a center to encourage school systems to open their schools and provide leadership for connecting learning in the community with learning in the classroom. Very idealistic. But it meant that for the little time that I actually tried to work in a YMCA after I finished that master's degree, I became disenchanted with the YMCA. The focus in that particular, and it was just the choice of where I went. It was in Darien, Connecticut. There's so much interest in building a Taj Mahal YMCA building that there wasn't a whole lot of interest in why. Why? And I became a pain in the ass.
Because you were a person that would ask the why. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Why?
From the get-go.
Why do we need all this space and all these things? And there were definitely good answers. Swimming pools, a swimming pool. But why? What do you do in a swimming pool other than have kids swim up and down that can change lives? And find that kid who doesn't play Little League and gets picked on for it, but who learns that he can swim like a fish. So that was more what I wanted of that context. But once I started out at a little teacher's college in another part of Connecticut, I knew I was home. And that's, I did the sort of outreach, but I also worked in an elementary school that was a lab school. And I was with professors who also were classroom teachers in the elementary school. And I soaked up their enthusiasm to the question of teaching. And off I went. And that's when I was found by one of the deans at the University of Connecticut who said, I like what you're doing. And I think you might qualify for a doctoral fellowship. And are you interested? I said, it can be in anything. I'm interested. I want to earn my PhD. And so I did. And that's where I met Peter. And the rest is a long, long story, but
that's the right. Yeah. There you are.
So teaching is, you know, not only is it ambiguity, Tennyson, but it's a restlessness. It's like, I've only got what, 75 minutes here.
Yeah.
That's not enough. Yeah. What else could I have been trying? You know, so it's always that feeling of, well, the next time and the next time.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure you'll resonate with that.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so that's a little bit of my biography.
I appreciate that, Dave. And of course, there's many aspects of our lives / biographies that are worth another day or another year and another decade sometimes too. If I stay on the learning piece, and when I do think of you, like reflecting on some of your origins there, getting into teaching, what did you love to do with your classes Dave, that helped call out some of that learning in your students? You probably had a few tricks and you probably had a certain disposition, I imagine, but what was it that you loved?
Well, speaking of disposition, yes, that's definitely important. The other day, an old friend who I hadn't been in touch with for a long time, who had been a guest in my classes, which is something I did, I always had
beautiful
someone from the real world, as we called it, there every week. And she said, I said, well, you know, I do miss being at school, being a professor. It's been 8 years. And she said, well, let me tell you something about what I observed when I was your guest. You had complete control of that class, and you never raised your voice, and you never threw a grade book out there as a threat or anything else that I knew of. They just knew that you were totally glad to be with them for that whatever amount of time you were there.
Minutes,
it came through. And so whatever you could do with them, they were eager to do. Not all of them. There was always someone who's on the fringe of that. And so you had them do the most remarkable things for a introduction to management for a group of sophomores. And every week they had what we call exercise that we would design and develop, me in the field of organization behavior teaching, and some that I brought in and modeled, and others I created. But it was always, okay, here's the reading. Here's what I say about it. Here's what you say about it. Now, let's dive into what an experience, that point about this is our presence moment now. Work it through, whatever the challenge may be. Talk it over a little afterwards. And then I always had intensive writing, which sometimes bugged the hell out of my poor working class students, because I had them writing constantly.
Right.
But I figured that was where I was preparing for them for the will be, because I knew that if they wanted to really condition their minds, you don't know what you know until you write it, right, Mr. Poet? And right. So they had a lot of writing, but it was always reflective. It's like, okay, what did we do? What did we learn? What did you draw from that guest?
Nice.
And what will you be doing with this? So back to the word do. So I was flattered when she said that I had total control, but you can hear managers and others say that I want to have control in a very different modality of the kind of control that shrinks people into compliant, frightened, can't stand being here kinds of human versions of ourselves. So I think I discovered, maybe by my teaching preferences, that the real control is self-control. And if I could show them that and encourage it and reward it, then I was doing my job.
Nice, Dave. Practice is a pretty keen word for you, as I hear you describing it. And it is for me, too. There's something utterly important and utterly nuanced also by the word practice, and especially when you add on practice as a way of being. Could you share some of that nuance of what that is for you, Dave?
The primary way of thinking that Peter wrote in the drafts that we worked on together is that practice is a conscious choice to continually pursue a stream of results in the context of changing situations and circumstances, always learning and growing. So think about that. What a way of life, huh? Among all the things that we do on a day-to-day basis, if we can elevate, and that's the right word, mm-hmm. in our own consciousness, conscious choice to go after results, accomplishments, attainments, outcomes that really matter to us, that give us tremendous satisfaction when we can set a little higher bar and get there, and another higher bar, well beyond what any external coach or teacher or trainer or manager is making us do. We're on our own about that growth, because it's an indefinite pursuit of objectives. It mm-hmm. never, in fact, you don't want it to ever stop. Mm-hmm. Similar to what I've said about teaching. Mm-hmm. So that is practice. Mm-hmm. And what I love about it is mm-hmm. someone who now writes, you know, seems to bug people every week that there's something for me about practice in the various social media, is that this is something, folks, you already have. Mm-hmm. This is not something to import. Mm-hmm. You could just find in yourself more than one of the ways of being mm-hmm. that give you the most joy and satisfaction. Then try to be with people in organizations where you can be encouraged, developed, excited, and not browbeaten. Mm. So you choose those contexts where you can thrive, and your payoff is learning and growth. What a deal, huh? Funny, because someone sent me a message, you know, through LinkedIn. And he said, geez, Dave, he said, your references of practice are kind of vague. Mm. And he said, I'd like to talk to you about it. I haven't reached back to him. I did respond and said, I'll get back to you. But what I would say to him is what I just said here, Tennyson. Mm. If you have only the vaguest feeling of what you love doing, mm. we don't have much that we can do it together, and in whatever literature that I'm representing probably won't be of much interest. Mm-hmm. As we find sometimes even in graduate schools, when we go into a classroom, it's like there's only the slightest interest. They had needed the 3 credits, and it was on right. a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. That's a teacher's nightmare, until you can really help people get rid of that sense of vagueness by saying it's personal. Mm-hmm. Practice is personal. Theory mm-hmm. is not personal. Mm-hmm. Theory and practice, as Peter said, and he took it from his Fritz Rosberger, he said, practice and theory are in a dance, and they need each other. So that's what Peter's mission in his last book was, to elevate practice, particularly to those academics like, you know, you and I are, and say, theory and practice are in a dance, but you don't want theory pulling itself away. You want them close so they can synchronize. And guess who does the synchronizing? The learner. That's where it comes together. Theory, practice, learner, do, outcome. Beautiful. That's the Venn diagram. I don't know. I want to say one other quick thing about Peter for you. Peter was a poet. One of his practices was to write poetry, as you are a poet. And when he wanted to bring a powerful analogy into his books, including our book, or into his classrooms, or as a consultant, he often would either create a poem mm-hmm. for the occasion, or he would bring in a poet that he loved, and he'd say, let's look at these connections, key word. I'm terrible at remembering that even the titles of poems, but there was one that he brought up in the podcast with me, and then later I found the poem, and it was about Observations of a Poet in a Cove on the, probably on the Maryland shore. And what he was saying is he was observing, noticing the life, the color, the sound, and the point of it was noticing. Big N, noticing. And he would go back, the poet would go back to that cove every day. And it would replenish and refresh him, his outlook. But he never was bored by being in the same place again and again. Something I think we've got to tell young people, they've got to learn again, because being in place and noticing and appreciating what we elders have discovered about the wonderfulness of being still is what Peter could do with a poem.
I appreciate hearing that, Dave. There is something about the words don't seem to land, but it's something in that direction. To me, there's always been something about how do we just pay attention to what's happening, and not just as a head question. And maybe that pulls me back a little bit to something you referenced, mind, body, spirit. Mm-hmm. Would you just say a little bit more about how mind, body, and spirit go together into this deliciousness of noticing?
Well, that certainly spirit, mind, and body, the YMCA motto, certainly captivated me when I was, just a kid, 7 or 8, 9 years old. I remember it was always there. You know, walk through the door. There was the symbol and the words, and then it was there in the YMCA camp that I loved going to, and eventually was a counselor. Sometimes you get tattooed with an ideology that's also universal. Body and mind, definitely. But the spirit part was what I was always most intrigued. Even as a kid, I would remember asking like a counselor or the director of the YMCA, what's the spirit? Where's that? Is that something? Is it because we're a Christian organization? Is the spirit about Christianity? And they would say, well, yes and no. It's Christianity is very spiritual, but it's not just that. And so one day, I think I remembered that, one of those aha moments where I had a bunch of day camp kids, 100 of them, that we had to bring up from the park and bring them indoors into the gym because it was storming out. And they were all, very restless, and it was hot in the gym. My job was to calm them and tell them a story. Mm-hmm. So they would all sit up on the bleachers, and then someone would say, Dave, what story are you going to tell us? And I would say, well, what do you want it to be about? and one little kid, these little Maine kids, how about a fish? I'd like a story about a fish. And I'd say, well, all right. Anyone have anything else you want the story about? And someone would say, yeah, well, I think fish is kind of stinky. And of course they all hee, 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 giggle, giggle, giggle. So I said, all right, I'm going to tell you a story about a stinky fish who hated how he smelled and wanted to smell as sweet as you guys do, which is pretty stinky after all. But the point is that 100 kids in me and in this moment of improvisation created the spirit of the why.
Yeah.
And because it created the harmony, we laughed and they forgot about the storm outside and missing some of their sport. And one of the observing counselors came over afterwards and says, Dave, how do you tame 100 kids? We could barely get them to be quiet.
Yeah.
for a minute, and now they were quietest for you. I said, yeah, well, I couldn't have pushed that story much further, and they would become restless. But in that moment, didn't you feel it? Didn't you feel what attention that we were giving to this idea of a stinky fish did in this room? And that's a little bit of what I mean by spirit. And the same in my classroom at the end, and hopefully in my podcasting. I think I bring mine for sure, as you do. We can't be together physically, but we at least use the Zoom camera to feel that connection. Mm-hmm. But the spirit is what comes through in the conversations that I've recorded, and hopefully mine and yours will in this one. Mm-hmm. It's, you can't see it. And yet someone might say, hey, listen, episode 147, who was that person? I said, well, it's just someone you would meet on the street, but I have a moment to find out something more about them. And it's the spirit that comes through in that person. Peter, by the way, wrote a whole book. He believed in it greatly. And particularly, he had an accident in 2001 that paralyzed him. So for the rest of his life, he was coping with being paralyzed from the waist down and couldn't go out and run around consulting and doing the kind of active teaching that he used to do. So he basically said, it's my body is sort of half there. My mind is all there, except when I'm in deep pain, but my spirit never flagged, never left me. And this is something he wrote in a memo mm-hmm. toward the end, but he wrote a book called Spirited Leading and Learning. So yeah, I think spirit matters a great deal, Tennyson. Don't you?
I do. I think that there are a lot of intangibles that are actually quite tangible that go into groups being in their learning together. I often use as a framing narrative, Dave, something about it's connection that matters first. And then we can be in our learning with one another, not quite so linearly as I'm saying it. And from that kind of connection and learning, we get the ability to experiment with one another. So I think there's some of the this and after this part that fits into that narrative for me too.
Yeah. I think what has attracted me to the conversations that we have through the Collaborative Change Library and my library and the Nexus for Change and the things that Steve Cady and Theo Ford Stiegler and others do is that what I think I find in all of us is the intangibility of spirit, yet the absolute presence of it in our Zoom calls or whatever. When we were, you and I and Charlie, I think, was on a panel. I think if I looked at I looked at that video afterwards, and
Keith, you're talking about
Keith. I'm sorry. Yeah. See what it is to be an elder.
There.
You don't remember names, but you remember the feeling, and that's what I remember. I remembered about that panel, and I remembered the three of us. And then someone had reached out afterwards. I think it might have been Carol Gorlick, and she said, "Did you guys meet in advance? Did you plan all that?" And she said it came together so well. I said, "No, we didn't meet in advance. We wrote a few things in advance, but what happened during the panel was synergy, which is what 89.5% spirit."
Nice.
So yeah, I love spirit, mind, and body.
Yeah, and I think, Dave, if I were to just pull on a little thread in there that I think is part of what you're saying. When people love what they do, like sometimes I feel there is a permission needed, and I don't quite like that language, but it's something, you know, an invitation needed that legitimizes doing what you love or following what you love. Like that brings a certain kind of passion, whether it's learning or learning about a particular domain and area of need, how we are with one another. Like I think it's something to re-invoke a narrative or a, you know, a purposed invitation that says you can do what you love. And when I see people doing what they love, boy, that's attractive.
Yeah, it really is. We've talked in some of these sessions that we refer to about love.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of them where we said, why not talk about love? Why mm-hmm. not? Why not make it the most prominent thing in our hearts and minds yeah. as we think about the dilemma of organizational life, all the not so great things that are going on with people? Why not proceed with love? So that's part of it. But the other part of it is, and once you're in there, in the middle of whatever people have allowed you come in to experience mm-hmm. as a consultant, perhaps an organization developer, that's when you really have to figure out if you love the people. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Peter was coached once and coached me. He said, love the people, but hate the system. And I said, what do you mean hate the system?
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's what's compromising people. That's mm-hmm. it's the sort of unnatural way that people have gotten used to being with each other that is the system. And if you went in just to change the system, but you didn't care a whole lot about the people, you would be a mechanic. You would say, well, you got to turn this process around and you got to add this methodology and so forth. Click, click, click. Okay. Give me my check. See ya. But an organization developer, as you and I are, when we just go right into it and we sense what the people are feeling and want to be and what makes them happy and what's making them miserable. We sense all that, but we have the objectivity to separate ourselves enough so that we can confidently send them forward into their ambiguities and into their searches and into their circles and all the methods that we use, but be there in case they need us, but not to replace them with our intellect and our physicality. So that's love. You know, my daughter's about to leave tomorrow to drive all the way back out to Wyoming, which is her second 6-month home. She's 6 months in Vermont, 6 months in Wyoming.
Mm.
And even though she's in her 50s, when that car goes down my driveway and she's going to drive 2,000 miles, do I want to run up and knock on the door and say, stay right here where you're safe and secure?
Right.
That would not be the loving thing to do. So I make sure her car's well maintained and she's got everything she needs for a safe trip. And then it's on her. But when she arrives, oh man, what a great thrill. I see her driving into Jackson Hole on my Where Are They Now finder.
Right.
And I it's the biggest thrill in the world.
Yeah.
So I'm really burning up your time, sir. So if you
is good. And
cut me off at any point.
I'm appreciating that you are speaking the language that is love. And sometimes that is love of our kids and our people near and dear to us. And you know, I just became a grandpa in the last 2 months, which has another kind of love that's available there. And so intriguing. And sometimes it's the love of the ways that we get to contribute. Like I carry a general storyline that people in organizations, most people, they want to contribute. They want to do good. They want to thrive. And yet we do have a fair number of systems that don't permit such things or kind of stuck. Like sometimes I wonder if one of the most significant things that people of our field can do is actually to create some temporary unstuckness and then maybe just maybe explore some of the principles and practices that might keep us a little bit more in that unstucked or, you know, rechosen way, something like that. So I'm appreciating the way that you're naming those kinds of things.
Yeah, the stuck, unstuck, of course, it goes back to our roots with Kurt Lewin, you know, and the freeze and unfreeze models and all the wonderful theory that we can draw on and have drawn upon. But I must say, in complete self-service, that the having somewhat of a sense of humor and the ability to come up with a story about a stinky fish is a way of helping people unstick.
Totally.
It gives them permission to laugh. It gives them, something different than the rigidity and some torture, if you will, of some of the systems that I would try to go in and help back in my consulting days. It was, here's a quick one. I had a wonderful experience for over 2 years as part of my faculty life as a professor in residence in a special care hospital near my school. They took on the toughest cases and rehabilitated people. So, I was overwhelmed with the competence of the nursing and the doctors and all the rest, and figured, what the heck can I offer here? Except that I realized that as wonderful as the hospital was, there were lots of points where things weren't working well. For example, staffing, getting people to come to work in storms, all the little things and sometimes big things, but all of them had consequences for the well-being of patients. So I said, what the heck can I do? What I did, among other things, was I had access via, back then, this is the late 90s, it was an email system distribution to about 1,000 persons in that staff, from the CEO to the anyone who had access to a computer. So every day that I was there, without fail, I would offer a little bit more of a story that I created about one of their fellow nurses and his family and the people with whom he came into contact. And I went on and on with that story. And I caught, and and it opened things up. And people would, I'd come down the hall. Now I wasn't that professor, you know, what is he looking after, you know, studying our managers. They would say, oh, Dave, that was interesting what you had Dana Gilbert doing. It's similar to what happened to me just last night. Oh, yeah, tell me about it. So that was the connection. But the other thing, real quick, again, I always say real quick and then I go on, is that I wasn't too familiar that the CEO was also reading all my stories. I figured, oh, God, he's probably got legal on me and so forth. He came to my office. They had a little office they gave me. Came to my office one day, Dave, and I said, how are you doing? He says, I have a bone to pick with you. Oh, God, here we go. That's the end of my residency. He said, you killed Elsa Godlack. And I said, yeah, I did. He said, I felt terrible. Elsa was a character in my ongoing story of the hospital.
Right. Right.
She had been there for over 30 years. She was the kind of person who would do anything. She was not certified as a nurse or anything else. She just, she cleaned rooms. But every time she was with patients, they seemed to light up. But Elsa was losing her health gradually in my story. She was in actually one of the beds in my hospital because she had become chronic. And my mom passed away January 2000. It was January 2000. I said, I know how I feel about losing my mother. I'm going to have Elsa die. And there was a few weeks after, you know, the people say, oh, man, why couldn't we get, couldn't you just have someone come in with a resuscitator?
Right, right.
I said, no, you don't. She had do not resuscitate orders. You know. So thank God for my imagination, right, Dennis?
There you go.
Well, thank God for you, too.
Thank God.
I appreciate it. I just love how you are.
I appreciate that, Dave. Thank you for encouraging and inviting and welcoming imagination and creativity and, you know, questions that wander around a little bit. I think sometimes we just need to wonder and wander a bit together. I'm really enjoying the spirit of our connection, Dave. And I am feeling that gratitude for you in a bit of a special way as an elder that has carried and stood for a particular kind of learning and experience together. It means a lot.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Dave, if people want to reach you, how do they do that?
Well, I think the most direct way is through LinkedIn or Facebook. I also on Instagram, but I post at least 3 or 4 times a week on those media, and they can just search my name and then they'll find the connections. Also, if you can find anything about On Practice as a Way of Being on the My Library World page, all my connections are right there too. So I'm findable.
Beautiful. I like that, Dave.
And I want to be found.
That's beautiful. Dave, thanks for joining today. I'll press pause and we can say goodbye.